Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Career Club Live. I'm Bob Goodwin, and I'll be your host, and thank you so much for joining. If you're watching us on YouTube, please feel free to subscribe, like, and comment. It really helps. And for all of you who are listening on your podcast device, that's cool, too. Please make sure that you subscribe and leave us a review and a rating if you're so inclined. Today's episode is brought to you by our newest service, which is called Next Placement, which is Career Club's approach to taking a more people-centric, empathetic take on outplacement. So if you're an HR professional listening today and you're forced to look at transition employees, we'd really encourage you to take a look at Career Club and Next Placement. Very excited to have on a guest today, Matt Burns. So speaking of HR, Matt is a former CHRO. He's also a very successful entrepreneur. He is the founder and owner of Bento HR, which lives at the intersection of business, technology, and people operations. And Matt's also the host of a very popular podcast called Thinking Inside the Box. So with that, Matt, welcome. I'm really excited about today's conversation.
This is a long time coming, Bob.
Amen. Well, yeah, we've gotten to know each other over the past few months, and it's been really great. I've learned a lot from you around HR topics in addition to podcasting things. So I'm just very grateful for our relationship and really appreciate you joining me today.
No, thanks for the invitation. I would extend the same thank you back to you. It's been a phenomenal, very fruitful relationship and looking forward to seeing how this chat goes.
Yeah. So for anybody who happens to be a podcaster listening, building your network of fellow podcasters is a great thing. You end up picking up some tips, tricks, and techniques. And I know that I've benefited greatly from Matt. So as is our want to do, Matt, we usually ask just a handful of little icebreaker questions to kind of warm us up and help people just get to know you a little bit more as a human being. So first one's pretty easy. Where were you born and raised?
Victoria, British Columbia, Canada, better known as the land of the newly wed and nearly dead.
I had not heard that one before. That's a good line. Where do we find you today?
I'm in Ottawa, Canada, the nation's capital. So I moved out here about the end of 2022, and it's actually kind of like a grown-up Victoria. It's the nation's capital. Victoria is the province of British Columbia's capital. So a lot of public service, a lot of university students, very green city, not a lot of traffic. It's great.
Very cool. That's awesome. Ottawa's beautiful. I've been to Ottawa, even when the snow wasn't as tall as me, and I'm 6'2". So just a little bit about your family.
Yeah, so all my family remained in Victoria, like most smart people do. Nobody really left the island other than me. But I, early on in my career, decided to make the move in my early 20s and kind of bounced around the world ever since. So my family does live in Victoria still. My brother's a real estate agent in Victoria. My father runs an aftercare business in Victoria. And then my mom lives just about up the island, about an hour or so, just about mid-island, in a place called Chemainus, known for their murals and ice cream.
I got to go. That sounds very cool. Very quickly, because I mentioned Bento HR, I mentioned podcasts, I mentioned former CHRO. Do you mind just painting a little bit of a picture of your career arc, Matt, and how it's landed you to where you are today?
Yeah, I need a title for that because it'd probably be something like Unexpected Journey or something smarter than that. But I started out 20 years in the corporate world, 15 of them in HR, the last five as an HR executive. I didn't really have a clear plan coming out of high school. University for me was something I was interested in, but ultimately I didn't see a great fit for a number of reasons, not the least of which was my family situation at the time required me to go and work and support our family. So I did that. And over the course of a career, went into retail and found a home in retail. Retail is a great industry. It is instant gratification. It's high pressure. And frankly, the credentials that you bring aren't as important as the job and the results that you deliver. And as a result of that, I accelerated very quickly through a number of retail organizations, culminating with my time at Walmart Canada, where I supported the organization in kind of a chief of HR staff role, leading their kind of center of excellence, supporting people analytics, engagement, and then a lot of restructuring projects, both outside and inside of human resources. After that, I was actually craving more of a university approach. I hadn't had the chance to really have that full university experience, despite the fact that I had climbed the ranks to an executive role in a Fortune 1 company, and went and did my MBA. Moved back to Vancouver from Toronto, where I was based with Walmart, back to Vancouver, where I was kind of from, bigger city in British Columbia, and started a new company, CHRO with a company called YISC. Think IKEA, but smaller and Danish. And I led their organization from an HR perspective in Canada, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Belarus, China, and Iceland. And together, we built an incredible digital transformation strategy for HR. Bob, when I got there, it was paper and pencils and good intentions. And when I left, it was fully digital, automated. We won a couple awards along the way for doing things like procuring 5 HR technologies in a single year, implementing them, integrating them, standing up an ecosystem, then built an analytics strategy on a budget of $4,000 and then rolled that into the business. It was a lot of fun. We had a great team, great support from the board, great support from the CEO and leadership team, and accomplished a lot. But ultimately, I think like most leaders in my position, we get kind of this ping and this desire for entrepreneurship. So I left the business in about 2018, launched my own, where I did much the same work that I was doing in the corporate world, supporting organizations through digital transformation, through changes, and helping CHROs make better sense of what's happening. Though, Bob, I'll admit, I did not expect a pandemic. Didn't really have a plan for that, and nor did most of my clients. That caused us to pivot. We did some cool projects along the way, working with Microsoft, putting on a virtual reality conference. That's a chat for another day. And then ultimately pivoted the business into what it is today, which is kind of half consultancy, half media organization. We help support organizations and their leaders in developing change strategies, advisory work, but we also talk a lot to senior HR leaders. It was a strategy we built as a consultancy to market ourselves, but ultimately we found lots of demand from vendors in the HR technology and services space who said, hey, we love access to your audience. We love the things that you're saying. We love the guests you have on board. Would you consider working with us in a content partnership capacity? And the answer was yes. So here's where we find ourselves today.
Well, it's great because, and I can see why the gravity pulled you in that direction, because the content that you produce is of the highest quality.
Thank you.
And it seems like there's a lot of noise sometimes and maybe a little bit less signal. And you guys really do kind of live on the signal part of that equation.
Well, super, it's important for me, sorry to interrupt, but it's important for me, I think, to say here, a lot of people talk about these subjects and they don't have any experience. So I think for us, it's really important that I was a practitioner. I've lived in the chair. I've sat down in those seats and I've had those tough conversations. And that brings a level of reality to conversations that may not be present if you haven't spent time in that role. Now, certainly, I don't want to denigrate the people that have spent time outside the function, but we try and be unique and lean into our competitive advantage, which is we've sat in the seat. We understand the challenges. So we really dig into the details in a way that individuals who haven't spent time in those roles simply can't.
Well, I used in the introduction, I used the word empathetic, and that's what you bring is empathy. I sat in your seat. I really understand what you're wrestling with. Mm-hmm. And oh, by the way, you may not have a giant budget. I didn't either. But that doesn't mean we can't do some of these things.
Exactly.
Very quickly, what do we find you doing when you're not staying as busy with all your work stuff?
It's a good question. Well, I'm in a new city, and Ottawa's great for museums. There's a number of really great museums in the city, and I'm a big museum buff guy. So last week, the girlfriend and I went off to the Air and Space Museum. Previously, we've gone to the Natural History Museum. Mm-hmm. So checking out those kind of one weekend at a time has been great. And the summer's out, so we're having a chance to walk around, visit some new communities, wander around, grab a coffee, grab a walk. That's what the focus has been so far. In the wintertime, we'll be doing ice skating and snowshoeing and all the other fun stuff that Ottawa has to offer.
We're going to have to get you to a beach, my friend. Our topic today, and this is coming on the heels of some conversations that we've had as we've gotten to know each other over the past bit of time, is around the business case for career transition, building the business case for career transition. Back on being empathy and having those hard conversations, and sometimes the most unpleasant day or period of time for an HR professional is when there is some kind of a staff reduction or there needs to be some type of an action taken. And I'd love for you to just, and there's several places we can start to break this down, but just if you could kind of just set the table for us, just on generally speaking, how you would help the listeners start to think about building that business case.
So let's do that. Let's break this down in a few pieces. So I think I'd start with, what's the role of the individual practitioner in having the conversation with somebody who's affected by a job loss situation? Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, that's not an easy conversation. And I don't mind saying, Bob, I've done it a number of times and it never gets any easier. And the moment it does get easier, I probably shouldn't do it, because then you get feeling detached from it. So I always try and bring empathy to the conversation, because I've been on the other side of that. I've lost my job as a consequence of a corporate restructuring. I know how that feels to feel unjust, and you're angry and you're resentful and you're scared and you're embarrassed and all the feelings that come up when you're told that the job you thought you were going to go to tomorrow, you're not going to go to anymore. and you're not going to get to leave on your own terms. That sucks. That's not an easy situation for anybody. So bringing that energy into the conversation, I try to do a couple things. The first one is I try and make sure everybody's safe. That may seem like a weird place to start, but unfortunately I've been party to or seen and heard situations where safety isn't properly thought of. And the fact of the matter is that in some situations you could have a medical situation that occurs after a communication. People don't always take challenging news well, and that could lead to a situation that involves the necessity to call medical support. It also, in some cases, could lead to violence in some situations. I've been party to those situations as well. Not pleasant, but it does happen when people don't, again, react well to situations they would rather not be part of. So safety to me is paramount. Safety to the people that we're talking to, safety to myself, safety to the people that are in the room with me. I don't deliver messages one-on-one for that exact reason. It has to be done in a safe way so that everyone feels good about things. So first and foremost, I look about safety. Secondly, I dig into empathy. And as I mentioned earlier, having an understanding of that situation from the other side, I am trying to understand that, Bob, this is not the time for a long rant about we're sorry and here's how things are going. When you tell someone they've lost their job, the moment you tell them that, everything else you say is just white noise. They don't hear it. They don't ingest it. They don't have any recognition of what you've said because their life is flashing before their eyes and they're asking themselves, how am I going to tell my partner? How am I going to tell my kids? How am I going to pay my mortgage? So I keep it straight and to the point. We've deliver a very tough message. I deliver it in as few words as possible. And then I create space for ultimately how they want to react to it. I offer support. I offer counsel. I offer access to resources. And then I give them assurances that if they do want to have a more detailed conversation, and in some cases they do, I'm able to then follow up with some additional information. And if they don't, then I provide them with the information that I do have in a written format and an email so they can review the information afterwards. And that includes access, again, to those resources, whether they be EAP programs, outplacement counselors, access to mental health practitioners, or all of the above, so that they feel like they're supported in what is otherwise a very difficult situation.
And so, yeah. So, well, no, I mean, that's just a phenomenal playbook. But I want to just go back one to safety, because I'm not sure everybody thinks of that first, you know, and yet, like you say, whether you've witnessed it or you've heard about it, it's like, yeah, sometimes people don't take bad news well, emotionally or physically, or, you know, maybe both. But moving on to the empathy part, one of the things, you know, that you've heard me say before is these are real people, not cells on a spreadsheet. And yes, do business decisions need to be made? And does it, you know, end up impacting people? Yeah. But they're people, and like in life, some of the worst losses, death, divorce, disease, losing your job, these are profound losses.
Yep.
And, you know, I've seen very manly men just collapse, just like, like, oh my gosh, like my identity just got evaporated. You know, I've got, as you said, I've got to go home and tell my partner, I've got to explain to my kids, you know, and it's like, it's devastating news for people. And your point about being very economical with your words is, I think, brilliant. I think it also just shows a real understanding of how people need to absorb, you know, what oftentimes is very stunning new information for them. And they just can't process. Their brain doesn't allow them to process anything for a while. And then, as you're saying, give them a little bit of room to breathe, probably literally and figuratively, to just start to process the news that they've been given.
It's hard, Bob, because the natural human instinct is that you want to lean in, you want to support, you want to talk because you're uncomfortable as a person delivering the message, and you want to be of support, and you think that the words will soothe. The words in a lot of cases don't. They actually make it worse. So I've learned the hard way. And again, I've done this a number of times. So over the course of time, I've refined my approach, which is direct, economical with the words, create lots of space. And I've sat in a room with somebody for an hour and said nothing while they just go through their own process, and they are on their phone and they're typing and they're thinking. And I'll check in every so often. How are you doing? But I'm not going to leave that person until I feel like they're in a safe space, until we all are in a safe space. And everything goes different. I've been in situations where, to your point, that big burly guy breaks down into tears. And I've been in situations where a woman who is 4'10" and 90 pounds reaches into her bag for a weapon. and everything in between. And you just can't predict a situation when you tell somebody that kind of hard news. To your point, when it comes to tough life news, loss of partner, loss of spouse, loss of child, loss of job, I don't want to paint an equivalency. They're all hard messages, but loss of job is definitely up there on that list. And people yes. don't always react how you'd expect them to.
Yeah. So you mentioned, you know, providing different resources, whether it's counseling, outplacement services, whatever. In our experience, and this is probably going to sound incredibly self-serving, but it's a topic that we've dove into, if I'm using my words right, but dove into very intentionally because, you know, we've dealt for a long time with candidates who are in job transition. Mm. And, you know, whether they chose to be that way or you're on the receiving end of, you know, you don't work here anymore, the support that they're given coming out of that, in our experience, has a huge impact on what happens next. And we've taken a lot of folks in who are what I would call outplacement refugees, where the company, you know, kind of checked the box, gave them something so that whether legally or in their own conscience or some for some reason have provided something, mm-hmm. but it wasn't great. And, you know, as a business person, you know, you could argue that, hey, the reason that we're letting go of folks is because there's a business need to, you know, preserve cash, you know, whatever the business needs have changed. We had this much employee base. We don't need as many now. So it's essentially a cost-saving maneuver. These people are leaving the company. Why would I throw more money in, you know, higher level outplacement services, counseling services, other things that you might do to support that person? And that's sort of the gist of the conversation today is like, is there a business case to do that? Or is it just soft, feel good? You know, I just want to be a decent human being. How would you react to that?
It's both. And I don't think this is self-serving. I think it's mutually beneficial. So, you know, we talked about the context of me involved in a one-on-one conversation. Let's talk about me in the context of me in a 5,000 or 10,000 to one conversation, because mm-hmm. I was the person in a lot of cases who built those spreadsheets. So I've seen mm-hmm. it from the individual, let's have a conversation perspective. I've had days where I've flown around the country and messaged five or six people in the same day, the same message. It's not an easy day.
Wow.
And I've also been the person who brings the spreadsheet forward to the CEO and says, this is the decision we have to make given the financial situations that we're in. Let's go through person by person and validate whether we want to do this. And the mm-hmm. names get long, and yet the names have meaning because you know some of those names and you yes. know some of those people and you know their family situations and you know what they've contributed to the company, both in terms of sweat equity and energy and time and years and mm-hmm. all the things people do when they pour themselves into their organizations. So it's not an easy conversation, even when you are distanced from the individual one-on-one, because you have to be, you understand the weight of the entirety of the activity. Now, you asked the question about business case. To my way of thinking, it doesn't have to be an either or, it's a both. And I think if you're willing to look at your business beyond quarter to quarter financials, there really isn't any other way to do this than to offer support beyond the initial conversation. To me, if I'm going to architect an idea or an activity, whether it's as a corporate employee or as a consultant, I wouldn't sign up for it and haven't signed up for it if there's not a robust outplacement plan in place that includes access to mental health resources, period. End of story. And I've had this conversation in a corporate setting before. It was simply where I was willing to actually put my job on the line in one company and say, I'm not doing wow. this unless you offer this support, because I'm not going to be party to an activity where someone then does something that we don't expect. And now we're managing things like reputational risk and survivor syndrome and the guilt that goes along with the activity itself. But let's break that down. So from an organizational perspective, let's talk about the business case. Let's remove the humanity for a minute. I'm going to bring it back. But for a minute, let's remove the humanity. If you're an organization and you're publicly traded or privately held, in today's era, everything that you do is under scrutiny. It goes on social media. It's talked about in your organization, both internally, but also externally through Facebook groups and, you know, Discord channels and Slack channels, whether they're company sponsored or not. The chatter mm-hmm. is happening in your organization, whether you're five people or 500,000 people. We yeah. know that. Therefore, when you undertake an activity like this, people are talking. They understand what happened, and they're communicating with, in some cases, their ex-coworkers to understand how were they treated? How was that conversation? How did it go? And those that feel some guilt because they're the ones that stay behind will react one way. And those that were close to people who've lost their jobs, who don't feel like those people were treated well, will react in another way. The consequence of those things could be a reduction in turnover, a reduction in productivity, and a reduction in engagement in the organization, none of which a company wants to achieve, and what most organizations don't think about when they make a financially based decision. Yes, I may have to your point, save cash, but what's the cost of productivity that drops by 5% in the next 2 quarters because you didn't handle an activity very well? Mm-hmm. What's the impact to your recruitment going forward? Because publicly speaking, the world found out that you treated your employees not very well. Do I want to apply for a job with your organization? Probably not. What's the impact to those who stay behind when they realize I could be next and this is how I'm going to be treated? Well, now I'm going to start looking for a job, Bob. Like there's catch on and second and third degree effects that occur when you don't handle this well. Now let's flip it. What if you actually treat people with respect? What if you are generous and thoughtful and treat them like humans with an otherwise very difficult situation? It's not the same as having your job, but if you offer somebody robust outplacement, access to mental health services, access to job searching tools, and somebody says in a generous severance package where it's appropriate, and someone says, hey, that sucked, that didn't feel good, but I didn't feel like I was abandoned. I didn't feel like I didn't have an alumni, an organization, a community to fall back on. I didn't feel alone in this process. And yes, it wasn't pleasant, but I don't hold any ill will towards company X. Right. I wouldn't tell people to not work for them. I wouldn't tell my previous coworkers that my boss didn't have my back and didn't respect me. And I certainly would encourage people to look for other employment because while a business decision was made and it affected me, I'm going to be okay. That's the difference between doing this right and not doing this right. And there's a very strong dollar value attached to that decision.
Yeah. And, you know, another knock-on effect. So I really appreciate what you're saying, because you're right. We live in an information transparent world now, and Glassdoor's a thing. And sorry. And you make a really good point that, is that a company that I want to work for? Because I went on Glassdoor and it's like, whoa, like, there's a bunch of one-star ratings here. Like they didn't get treated very well. You're right, too. The people that are left behind, you know, they're getting the networking calls coming after, right? And it's like, hey, yeah, it sucked. You know, hey, how are they treating you? Like, are you doing okay?
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, it's kind of like, this is probably a poor analogy, but I always talk about lost luggage. Do you want your luggage to get lost? No. How do they treat you after they've lost your luggage? That could make you more of a fan than before they lost your luggage, because they really over-delivered on making sure I was taken care of. Mm-hmm. Well, similarly, like if I've been left, one of the people that was not affected, but now I'm networking with the people who were, because they're trying to find their next thing. And I find out the company really did right by her. Like, that's impressive, you know, because the company's probably not going to, you know, like send that out in a mass email. Here's the package everybody got. But you're going to find out, and either it's going to make you like, hey, that sucked, but wow, the company did the right thing. They did the best they could do under very trying circumstances. I'm still here. I'm still in. Yep. Versus they screwed them. The other thing that comes out, and I was just reading a Wall Street Journal article on this this week, where it's talking about what drives off the A players. Mm. And this is a very real thing that drives off A players and can make your organization a magnet for mediocrity, is that if you're not taking care of people for the entirety, and this includes the offboarding process, the A players are like, I can share my talent. I have choices. And you're indicating to me very clearly that this isn't a place for A players. I'm going to go find my next home. And the data that supports the higher turnover rate, the higher, you know, attrition of people that are scoring in the top 40% of performance, attrite at a higher rate when there's been an action taken that they felt wasn't handled well.
Well, beyond that, I've been in conversations as a CHRO where I've said to my recruitment team, this company just laid off 500 people. Call the rest of them and see how they're doing. It's real. And in a world where demographics are very much such that more people leave the workplace every single day than are entering the workplace because of the aging population in North America, there's a finite number of resources. And if I get wind that an organization did not treat their employees well, I'm going to call their A players and I'm going to ask them how they're doing. And I'm going to paint a picture of my organization and how it can support people like them in a way that's done properly. And that may sound a bit cutthroat and a bit competitive, but we talk about the term war for talent. That's what the war for talent looks like. So when you signal as an organization that you've gone through job loss, yes, it makes Wall Street happy in some cases, but it also makes your competition very happy in some cases. So we can see, okay, there's a hole in the boat. And now it's an opportunity for us to be able to see, do you actually have good relationships with the people in your organization? And in some cases, Bob, the answer is yes, it was handled well. People feel respected and there isn't much of a leak. But I've definitely been part of activities where we were able to grab other people from the organization who then had to call the people back they laid off to fill in the gaps of people that we
Oh, my gosh. when you say that, I'm like, yeah, that's probably exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. Hey, Matt, can you come back on a consulting basis? Or hey,
at 30% premium? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. So now you brought up an interesting thing that kind of kicks a different lens onto this, which is you said Wall Street, which you know makes me think of shareholders mm-hmm. and the contrast between shareholders and stakeholders. And what the stakeholder effect of doing this well and not doing it well might look like.
Well, I mean, stakeholders, that's a much broader definition. So a shareholder really has one consideration, which is in most cases, they're considered with share price. And when you're a board member or an executive member at a publicly traded company, your sole fiduciary responsibility is to enrich the shareholder, period, full stop, end of story. We can have a discussion about the appropriateness of that in another conversation, but that is the rule and that is the way the world works. Stakeholders is much broader. That it does include your shareholders, but it also includes, to your point, your customers. It includes your vendor partners. It includes your internal employees. It includes the broader media. It includes, you know, community groups. It includes different constituencies that may not have direct representation within the strategies of the company, but absolutely have second and third degree effects. And I've worked in government organizations where we do something and then I'm talking to media and I'm talking to First Nations groups and I'm talking to school boards and I'm talking to business associations and three levels of government. And that was the cost of doing business in an organization that had a bit of a government connection. In some privately held companies, it's much easier. Your stakeholders could be internal, external, and it's pretty straightforward. But I think what I would say just in general, Bob, is that whether you're a privately held company, a mom and pop shop that works in Omaha, Nebraska, whether you're a government organization that's based in Ottawa, Canada, you have more stakeholders today than you did 10 years ago, and you're probably going to have more 10 years from now. And you have to look at the bigger picture because the world is too small. Things don't happen now in isolation. They don't happen in silence. The word does get out about how you treat people. And increasingly, your customer, we haven't talked about this yet, your customer will make decisions on who they work with based on how they treat the people in the organization. There are places in Ottawa that I will not shop at because I know they treat their employees poorly. And as a consequence, they're not getting a dollar from me. I'll go to the competition and I'll support them growing their business, but I'm not going to give a dollar to a company that treats their employees, you know, poorly. So customer impacts, employee impacts, societal impacts, they're everywhere.